Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's visit to Puerto Rico today and examine a number of issues raised in Obama's speech with Luis Martinez Fernandez. He is an expert on Puerto Rico and a professor of history at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans, who are an increasingly important voting bloc in the key swing state of Florida. Then, with today's confirmation by the Senate Armed Services Committee of Leon Panetta to be the next Secretary of Defense, we will discuss the expectation that Panetta will make the $400 billion in budget cuts he's promised. William Hartung, the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, joins us to question whether outgoing Defense Secretary Gates really did save the taxpayer $300 billion and whether Panetta will be able to eliminate any of the greater number of major weapons programs now in place since Gates arrived at the Pentagon. Then finally, R. Clark Cooper, Executive Director of the Log Cabin Republicans, joins us. He will give his analysis of how the seven Republican presidential hopefuls fared in last night's debate and whether those who were absent stand a better chance than those who were present. I'm now joined by Luis Martinez Fernandez, who is a professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He is a historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Good afternoon to you and all listeners.
And Luis, the president's trip to Puerto Rico is the first official presidential trip since JFK went there in 1961. And I guess in terms of what he said there, is that he will back a referendum on the island's status and saying that essentially he would support any choice the Puerto Rican people made. Now, what I think most of our listeners probably don't know is the choices that do exist in terms of a referendum. There are four of them: independence, a U.S. state, a free association, or a commonwealth. Can you walk us through those choices?
Sure. Historically, those have been the options. The three primary options being, on the one hand, statehood, on the other hand, full independence, and then two in-between or middle-of-the-ground formulas. One is the current Commonwealth status, which is very similar to the free associated state. And that means that Puerto Rico, as that sort of a hybrid status, has some of the responsibilities and some of the privileges of being a state, and also some of the responsibilities and privileges of being a free country.
Well, one of the anomalies there is, of course, that Puerto Rico, you're U.S. citizens. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but they cannot vote in federal elections, except they can't vote in the general elections, but they can vote in the primaries. So, you know, explain that.
That's right. That is one of the aberrations, if you will, of the present status. And when it becomes the thorniest, it has to do with the inability to vote for a president or for representatives in Congress that then make decisions about war and peace. And on the other hand, Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens are subject to a draft, if there is one, to fight wars over which they have no saying.
So there are more. The assumption here about President Obama's trip today to Puerto Rico, where he's going to spend a couple of days, is that he is going down there to shore up Democratic support in Central Florida, where there are about 850,000 Puerto Ricans living there, of the nearly 5 million here in the United States, which is more than what the 4 million that live on the island itself.
Yes, that's correct. Just in the past few years, the Puerto Rican population in the mainland has surpassed the population on the island, which is not too anomalous. There are many small islands in the Caribbean, Barbados comes to mind, that have as many people living abroad as they have on the island. And yes, I would agree with the point that this trip is more about shoring up a Puerto Rican-Florida vote than anything that has to do with Puerto Rico per se. That said, the links, and certainly the political links between the island-based population, Puerto Ricans, I mean, and Puerto Ricans in the United States, these links are very, very close, and there's a great deal of political collaboration, if you will. I have heard of people who live in Orlando, but they're not official residents of Orlando, yet they travel to Puerto Rico to vote there. I have heard and I've actually witnessed efforts to register voters here on in Florida, Puerto Rican voters, and these efforts are strongly supported and actually even coordinated by political forces on the island. So it's more of a transnational population, if you will, a population that is very young in terms of, or I should say very recent in terms of its residence in Florida. And those links are very, very strong.
But we know about the Cuban-American voting bloc down in Florida that is a key voting bloc, and it is fairly, consistently Republican. I assume that one of the reasons the president's down in Puerto Rico courting votes in Florida is that the people as you mentioned, they have strong ties to the island, that they will vote Democrat in Central Florida.
Yes, that's correct. Actually, I've been thinking about this quite a bit over the last couple of years, and we know, of course, that the Cuban vote in Miami and elsewhere in South Florida is strongly Republican. However, that has been changing. So if we look at second-generation Cuban-Americans, they tend to vote slightly Democratic, actually. If we look at those Cubans who have arrived since the 1990s and have already become U.S. citizens, they're also leaning Democratic. So that Cuban Republican vote reality is changing. But I should also add that the Puerto Rican vote in Central Florida and elsewhere in the state of Florida is a population that has begun to neutralize the Cuban Republican vote. We saw that very clearly here in Orange County, the county where Orlando sits, and it's almost unbelievable the fact that not one presidential candidate since Franklin Delano Roosevelt had won in Orange County until Obama in 2008. And then to see that margin of victory was close to 20 points, that's just incredible. The same thing happened in Osceola County, which is the county where Kissimmee is, and that is a strong Puerto Rican bastion. So that is my thesis, actually, that the Puerto Rican vote, with its Democratic tendency, about 66% or so, is already neutralizing the Republican vote among Cubans, and that's very important, and that explains why so much attention on the hand of Obama towards Puerto Rico and towards Puerto Rican voters.
Again, I'm speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, a professor of history at the University of Central Florida, where he researches the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. So the other issues that the president has been dealing with down in Puerto Rico, again, he's basically said whatever the Puerto Ricans decide, that he will honor. But there's been a history of political tension, has there not? And there were a group of 20 or so Puerto Rican nationalist demonstrators, pro-independence demonstrators, who had an all-night vigil in San Juan ahead of the president's visit, calling for the release of three Puerto Rican nationalists imprisoned in the United States. So since you're a historian, I have a vague memory. Was it a group of Puerto Ricans who went into the United States Congress, I think, when Harry Truman was president, and shot up and killed some people?
Yeah, that's correct. And there was also an attempt on the vice president's life. This was in the 1950s. Most of those participants have died. A couple were released, I believe, by Jimmy Carter. And these are still sticking points, really. I'm not sure what Obama will do. I think that because these individuals were accused of terrorist activities, this is not the best of times to release people who have been charged with those charges. And certainly the fact that Obama politically is so weak at this point in the United States, I don't think it's the appropriate time.
Right, but what's the history of this animus, though? Because I my understanding is that the president was greeted fairly warmly down there, and that the decisions about the future of the island rested with the people on the island, and they simply haven't been able to make up their minds. They've had three or four attempts at it at referenda, and so the confusion seems to be on that side. So I'm trying to get an understanding of what radicalizes people to the point where they'd walk into the United States Congress and shoot up a bunch of congressmen.
Yes, well, Puerto Rico was acquired in 1898 by the United States as a result of what is called the Spanish-American War. And from the very beginning, there was opposition by some against U.S. occupation and then the establishment of a civilian government thereafter. There was opposition to the quote-unquote imposition of U.S. citizenship on all Puerto Ricans. So that has very deep roots. I need to say, however, that when we talk about the nationalist and the pro-independence forces on the island, they are a very small minority. The pro-independence party, actually, during the last election in 2008, did not get enough votes to be automatically inscribed for the following election. So it's a small group. It's a very vocal group, I should say, and they are adamantly opposed to the establishment of statehood for Puerto Rico. We all know that once you become a state, you can't break away. The Civil War in this country was all about that. On the other hand, the two other formulas that are the main formulas are the statehood formula. The current party in power on the island is a pro-statehood party. The other formula is the Commonwealth formula, and that is supported by the Popular Democratic Party, which was voted out of office in 2008. So what we have is a situation where these two parties each carries about 45 to 48% of the vote, and there's no movement in either direction. That is, these two parties have been alternating in power without moving beyond the 50% vote that would be needed to start any negotiation. The fact that Obama said that this is up to the Puerto Ricans to decide is nothing new. Presidents have been saying that all along. And the problem is that how does that happen? How does that happen? How do we move towards a change in status when there's a stalemate between two parties, each with about 45% of the vote? Now, the way that can be altered, and I don't think it was a good idea when President Bush created a status commission, and what they did was that they stacked the odds in favor of statehood, the way in which they proposed not one but two referendums, actually. The first option was, do you want Puerto Rico to change or to stay the way it is? Now, if the decision to change had the majority vote, then the only two options that were proposed by this presidential committee were independence or statehood.
Well, I can't understand how for example, Congressman Gutierrez represents Illinois. He grew up on the island. He's calling for independence. Where would the how would an independent state be viable? I take it the support on the island isn't that great for that. But there is obviously an emotional and historical component there at play. Is that right?
That's true. It's also a matter of identity and a natural inclination for people to rule themselves. All of that is very understandable. However, Puerto Rico as it stands is a poor country. Certainly we compare with some of the poorest states in the United States. Now, what would happen if all of the billions of dollars that flow to Puerto Rico as a result of this special relationship, what would happen if these dollars no longer flow to the island? The pro-independence leadership claims that Puerto Rico can on its own stay afloat. I haven't seen the numbers, and I'm convinced that would not be the case. Just look around and see other countries nearby, the Dominican Republic, for example. They're very, very poor countries. And Puerto Rico, on the other hand, is very poor in terms of natural resources. Even Cuba, they found oil recently that could be enough to actually export. Puerto Rico does not have those resources.
So just in closing, then, Luis Martinez Fernandez, it sounds like, though, the fact that the U.S., that Puerto Rico is kind of a welfare state, but the people can't vote, that smacks to me of a kind of paternalism that's a little unpalatable. And who's responsible for the fact that these people can't vote? They're U.S. citizens. They can vote in the primaries, but they can't vote in the general elections. And, you know, frankly, that doesn't make any sense. So just in closing, what's the explanation for that?
I agree. It makes no sense. Congress makes those determinations, and Congress agreed gradually over the years in the 20th century to grant Puerto Rico more and more powers. However, the power for Puerto Ricans to vote while living on the island is one that has not been granted. And in closing, I would say this could be very problematic. Imagine what Republicans would say if we all of a sudden have two new senators from Puerto Rico and seven or eight congressmen, most of whom would be Democratic. So the Republican Party would not like to see that happen.
Well, now you're making sense. Now I see the picture. Thank you so much for joining us. By the way, the governor of Puerto Rico is actually a Republican. I thank you for joining us, Luis Martinez Fernandez.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Again, I was speaking with Luis Martinez Fernandez, who's professor of history at the University of Central Florida. He's an historian of Latin America and the Caribbean who focuses on the histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. He was born in Cuba, graduated from a Puerto Rican university, and currently lives and teaches in Orlando, Florida, which has one of the world's highest concentrations of Puerto Ricans. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether the new Secretary of Defense just confirmed today will actually live up to his promises to cut the defense budget.
Perdición. Mas si es cierto que todos definen.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by William Hartung, who is the Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy?, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets, the Prophet Moses, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And today, the Senate Armed Services Committee confirmed Leon Panetta, who's I'm sure will be voted on and confirmed by the full Senate to become the next Secretary of Defense. Now, in terms of the expectation that he's going to make the $400 billion in budget cuts that the Obama administration have promised, let's begin with his predecessor. He claims to have saved the taxpayers $300 billion, but I take it that is rather largely an illusory claim?
Yes. Basically, he fudged the numbers by taking savings from programs that were going to end anyway. He would end one program, start a very similar program. So it ends up when he is leaving office now, there are more major weapons projects than when he came in, and they cost a bit more than they would cumulatively when he came in. So not only are there no savings, but actually there's been an increase.
And how do they do this sleight of hand then? I mean, how do they move money around and make it look like they're saving? Because yesterday the LA Times carried a front page story that there's $6.6 billion of cash missing from the Iraq war that the Pentagon simply they can't account for it. They assume it's stolen, but they simply can't account for it. So with that as a kind of preface to the question, what kind of bookkeeping do they do at that place?
Well, they've never been able to be audited, so the bookkeeping is certainly not up to the task of running that kind of hundreds of billions of dollar operation. And in terms of the alleged savings that Gates was talking about, the main thing is they're all savings in the future. It's compared to what we might have spent if we had everything we wanted. So Senator Carl Levin of the Senate Armed Services Committee asked the administration, how much of that is going to come in this current budget proposal, and how much of it is from the Pentagon versus other related agencies like Homeland Security, and they have yet to answer him. So part of the game is you keep pushing the savings off into the future and say, we will save that once we change our plan down the road.
Well, at this point, William Hartung, we're at about $800 billion a year for the defense budget?
The regular Pentagon budget and the wars is running over $700 billion. And then if you look at related things like Homeland Security and the intelligence agencies and the debt attributable to the wars and cost of veterans benefits and so forth, then you'd be well over $1 trillion of military-related, security-related spending.
Per year at this point?
Per year, yes.
Yeah, and we know that, I don't know whether it was deliberate or accidental, but over the years, a lot of these costs have been spread out over other agencies, haven't they? For example, the Department of Energy controls a nuclear weapons portfolio, which used to be in the Department of Defense. Transportation has the Coast Guard, et cetera.
Yes, I think there was, an intention behind it because, I think the Pentagon budget is huge enough, but if it was also covering the nuclear warhead complex that's lodged in the Department of Energy, the Coast Guard has now got a new $24 billion project to outfit the new fleet, new aircraft, basically an entire new Coast Guard. If that was under the Pentagon's umbrella, if we knew where they're taking the $60, $70 billion a year they spend on the intelligence community, is it hidden in the Pentagon budget? Is it separate? Where is that money lodged? If all that were in one department, it would be much larger than this record-breaking figure that exists now.
So what are the Obama administration talking about when they talk about $400 billion? Panetta, who of course comes out of budget. He was a budget director under Clinton. I mean, he's got that's his resume, isn't it? That's his selling point here. That's why they did the musical chairs, surely. What do you think of this $400 million promise? Is it real?
Well, they haven't given us any real examples of what's going to get cut. They've announced the number. They haven't said, you know, this weapon system's going to go, that weapon system's going to go. There are some that Gates had already said he would cancel, like the expeditionary fighting vehicle for the Marines, which will be replaced by something, somewhat scaled-down version of that. But those things were already in the pipeline. So allegedly this $400 billion is going to be, new cuts of some sort. And a colleague of mine, Gordon Adams, at the Stimson Center in Washington has pointed out that, you know, if the $400 billion were real, all they would have to do is freeze the Pentagon budget at the record level it's at now, let it grow for inflation, they'd save $400 billion compared to their ambitious plans. So were they to do it, it wouldn't be a huge hit on the Pentagon, but it's not clear that they're even going to do that.
So are they planning to, I guess then they don't want to announce what's going on in Afghanistan, and they can't really claim to want to save money there because they haven't made up their mind, even though it looks as though there's going to be some kind of withdrawal.
It seems like they're talking about the Pentagon's regular budget, so not the cost of Iraq, not the cost of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where they would get these savings over the 10 years. But the trick, well, actually, it's a dozen years. They've also stretched it out. All the other plans are 10 years. Theirs is a dozen years. And then that money, they call it security spending. So some of it could come from Homeland Security. Some of it could come from intelligence or the Department of Energy. So it's not clear that the Pentagon will bear all of that $400 billion. That's another thing that they have yet to clarify.
Well, clearly the huge change that happened with the end of the Cold War, this profound shift in the security landscape where throughout history, we've had these national wars between nation states or alliances of nation states. And suddenly, with the collapse of the Cold War, it appears that there are no real likelihood of any great nation states facing off in any kind of world war. If anything, that threat's been replaced by subnational and transnational threats, ethnic, religious divisions, drugs, crime, guns, terrorism. That's the new landscape. And the Pentagon seems to have spent so much of like a giant super tanker, turning. They've been still spending on these useless fighter planes. It's Cold War relics, which are hugely expensive. Where would you say the mindset is now in terms of the weapons that they're buying and the changed security landscape out there? Are they back, in 1990 or 2000 or... Where would they be, do you think?
I think they're kind of, it's kind of an overlay. You know, in the 90s, the argument was, well, you have to fight the regional powers like Saddam Hussein or North Korea. So that's still part of the mix. Then after 9/11, you have to be able to fight terrorists, which they took a very expansive view of what that meant. Basically, any country that might harbor a terrorist was fair game. And then... There's still, there's not a Soviet threat per se, but they're starting to look ahead and say, China's the next big rival. They're building up their Navy. Therefore, we have to be prepared to continue to build up our conventional forces also. So it's sort of like they've added missions, but they haven't really given up any missions.
So what about the politics of this, William Hartung? Because I noticed that Jim Webb, who's leaving the United States Senate, who's a veteran, and he wore his son's boots, etc., and identifies with the troops as opposed to the boys and the girls, as opposed to the toys. And he and McCain, who's another veteran, they tried to get the administration to take a more realistic approach to Okinawa, which is a kind of base that they've had since World War II, where the U.S. military bases on that island basically make it impossible for the people on the island to live. I mean, it's just overwhelming. And what the recent Japanese prime minister before this current one, he thought that they could finally get the United States to relent, and he got booted out for sticking his neck out on Okinawan independence. And now Webb and McCain are saying, why don't we just consolidate these various air bases onto this one air base and at least acknowledge a little bit of the needs of the local people. But this kind of empire mentality seems to rule.
Well, yes, there's been no talk about, why would the United States need 700-plus military bases overseas? What are they for, other than the notion that, the United States is always on the side of the angels and has to be ready to deal with any bad guy, any bad country, any bad actor anywhere in the world on short notice, as if other countries, couldn't defend themselves, and as if all of these threats really are amenable to military solutions. So it is an imperial mindset, because part of the imperial mindset is to, of course, argue that you're always on the right side, you're always, doing good for others, it's for the benefit of others, never for yourself.
But how does that gel with the fiscal realities? If the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as he did recently, said that the deficit is a national security problem and that the Pentagon has to accept its part of the need to cut spending, where's the you can't have an empire and you can't have an empire on the cheap. I mean, I guess the Romans learned that towards the end. But what are the countervailing forces against the attrition and of empire?
Well, I think I think there are going to be some cuts, even, whether the Pentagon wants them or not, just because of the fiscal situation. But, it hasn't quite gotten traction yet, this notion that these cuts have to be real. But a lot of the current plans, even some of the, progressive arguments are, well, we can do everything we're doing now for less. There's a lot of talk about efficiencies, cutting a weapon system there, weapon system another place, perhaps working more with allies, but the notion being same mission, same objective, just done in a slightly different way, saving some money, as opposed to why do we need all these missions? I mean, even Gates said, any president, anybody who recommends to another president to fight a major ground war like in Iraq or Afghanistan should have their head examined, but they haven't acted on that that statement. I mean, they're not saying, oh, let's scale back the size of our Marines and Army. Let's not assume we're going to have to fight one of these kinds of conflicts. Basically, they're pocketing, that money and keeping that capability while, some are claiming that they may not ever use it.
Right. And in the meantime, the killing of bin Laden indicated to a lot of people that you don't need this huge footprint. And as much as that was celebrated, it was quickly forgotten. Right, in terms of a smaller footprint.
Yes, I mean there was more discussion of the Anthony Weiner scandal and the fact that bin Laden was killed. Right. So I think part of it is just the short-term mentality that exists. But I think also the Pentagon hasn't been held to account. To say, well, if you did this with special forces, why do you need 100,000 troops there? Iraq, of course, had nothing to do with terrorism until they got there, and then there were some terrorist groups that kind of followed the troops and developed war. So
they made themselves a target, in effect.
Exactly. And so
what about just? I just want to quickly get onto a couple of subjects before we wrap up here in a couple of minutes. And one of them is I recently spoke with Pierre Spray, who designed the A-10 and the F-16, which are two of the most successful weapons in the U.S. inventory. They're still being used in Afghanistan. Even though the Air Force never wanted the A-10. And in the couple of days that they were used in Libya, they were very effective. And then the minute they were taken out, the stalemate began when Obama handed this off to NATO, and they seemed to be completely feckless. And as Gates dressed them down the other day, saying, what's wrong with you guys? You know, you can't get your act together. But the long and the short of it is, what I had one of those light bulb moments with Pierre Spray, where he was explaining how they fought his very successful weapon systems tooth and nail, the bureaucracy in the Air Force in particular, and he only got it through some clever maneuvers with the Secretary of the Air Force and Defense at the time. But he said, "You don't understand, you know, kid, wake up. It doesn't matter whether these weapons work or not. And don't you think there will be a national debate if that's what's going on here, that we're spending trillions and trillions of dollars on these vast, complicated systems? And we know from what just happened with the NSA whistleblower that they spent $1 billion or so there on a total turkey that General Hayden was pushing. And they always put this guy in jail because he told the truth."
Exactly. Well, I think it is a national scandal, and I don't think it's well understood that a lot of this is driven by the military-industrial complex, by the kind of, the ideology of the armed services, that more is always better, more sophisticated is always better, even when it often ends up that simpler aircraft like the F-16 or the A-10 are in decent numbers, can do more than an F-22 or an F-35 or all these, sophisticated, costly, underperforming stealth aircraft that they're trying to outfit the force with.
So what would it take then for a cost-conscious America who's being asked to downsize and tighten their belts, and what would it take to have a national debate about what's really needed? And we don't need a Rolex; we can get by with a Timex.
Well, I think part of it's going to be driven by the larger budget debate. Some of these proposals for what they want to do with Medicare and entitlements and basic programs, not only for low-income people, but for the middle class, I think will spark some pushback of, why do we need to do this? If there's a deficit, why are we not looking at the huge amounts we spend on the military? And I think in that context, I think it would be possible to have a debate about what the military's for, not just, carving off a system here or promising to get rid of some waste over there.
Well, I guess just in closing, William Hartung, your book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, we recently had the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell address, and it seems to be, sort of people recognize it, that it exists, but I guess the problem is that if you combine the power of the military-industrial complex, the amount of money that they get from the taxpayer, but you have to add to that this new dimension that we have now, thanks to the Supreme Court, where these big corporations can actually lobby and buy politicians with taxpayers' money. And we already see on television now Boeing and Lockheed doing these totally self-serving ads, showing how patriotic they are and how much they care about the fighting men and women and how they're protecting us and we can all sleep safely in our beds tonight. And they're doing that on taxpayer money.
Well, yes. And I mean, a company like Lockheed Martin gets 98% of its money from either the U.S. government or through foreign arms sales to other governments. So pretty much anything they do is going to be on our tab. And, they've become more aggressive, audacious, and absurd in some of their advertising campaigns and some of the other things they do for members of Congress to help curry favor, not just the campaign contributions, but giving to the congressperson's favorite charity, giving to a university that's naming a chair after the person, all kinds of sort of ancillary little party favors for the members of Congress to keep them on board.
Well, now, though, the Republicans shut down an amendment that would require transparency in the amount of money they donate to candidates. So now they can literally give as much money as they like to their favorite congressman and senator, who is all too willing to write the checks.
Well, yes, and also there was some talk of they should tell what they're giving to trade associations, to think tanks, to other entities that act on their behalf, and that so far has also been basically bottled up.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, William Hartung. And again, William Hartung is the author of this book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Republican about the seven Republican presidential hopefuls, how well they fared in last night's debate, and whether those who were absent stand a better chance than those who were present. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we are trying to get through to our guest, R. Clark Cooper, who is the Executive Director of the Log Cabin Republicans. Previously, he was a Deputy Director of Florida Governor Jeb Bush's Federal Affairs Office. He then joined the Army and served in Iraq. His last appointment was as Counselor at the United States Mission to the United Nations. And in May of 2010, he took over as executive director of the Log Cabin Republicans and has been working with congressional Republicans to further LGBT equality. He has just been elected to the District of Columbia Republican Committee, and he was having a meeting of the Republican Committee when I talked to him earlier, and he swore to us that he would be ready at 20 minutes to 9 East Coast time. So he's running 5 minutes late, and we will hopefully get through to him in the meantime. The debate last night, of course, featured seven of the candidates, some of the more important ones, and certainly the ones that get more attention in the press, particularly Sarah Palin, were not present. And there was the general reviews of from the media. First of all, it's worth mentioning that it was the event was put on by CNN, who tried to make it a monumental and important event, I think because their ratings are so poor and because they're in such a battle with Fox News for relevance. And so they were only too happy to trumpet the importance of this debate, which is happening rather early, shall we say, given that the election year has yet to begin. And the seven were, well, one of them, of course, was Michelle Bachmann, congresswoman who pretty much just got the same constituency backing her as Sarah Palin, who was not there. So she took advantage of the of this. I'm not sure how many people were listening or watching, probably only a couple of million, given the ratings that CNN have. But she did take advantage of the situation to announce her candidacy. There was, of course, the front runner who ran last time, and he Mitt Romney. He was on as well with Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota. They're basically calling Pawlenty and Bachmann the Minnesota Twins. And he was also joined by Rick Santorum, who was a former senator from Pennsylvania, who's also trying to carve out the Tea Party right-wing evangelical territory, which, of course, is a growing constituency in the Republican Party. And then you had Ron Paul, who is a Republican but largely a libertarian. And then, of course, you had the president of, or the former CEO of Godfather Pizza, who I did a piece on recently with the Washington correspondent of Aldenet, who had been to some of these CPAC meetings where he was carving out some territory as quite a star and a plain-speaking kind of businessman in the mold of Ross Perot. Where, you know, you kick the tires and lift up the hood and you fix the problem. But he actually was, of all of them, was, I thought, the flattest and clearly didn't know much about politics. And not that it matters nowadays. Of course, you don't have to know anything. You don't even have to know American history, apparently. but the one moment that could have been interesting was when Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, ex-governor of Minnesota, was given the opportunity to attack Mitt Romney, who he had attacked earlier by conflating Obamacare with Romney Care from when Romney was the governor of Massachusetts. And he was asked repeatedly by the CNN moderator, John King, to repeat what he said, or at least justify what he said, and he refused to do that and kept attacking Obama, which, of course, everybody did endlessly. But of course, I suppose you could arguably the Democrats did the same thing with George W. Bush, but at least when the Democrats attacked George W. Bush, their attacks were based on fact. They weren't making up stuff like the Godfather Pizza guy who claims that Obama comes from Kenya. So the long and the short of it was that they were Pawlenty wimped out. So I think he's toast. I think he's going to be branded as a wimp. And the other guy who was a train wreck coming in, of course, was Newt Gingrich. His campaign just imploded the other day while he's off with his wife on a Greek island vacation while they're taking a yacht and lying in the sun, the staff were going crazy, saying he was missing out on important events in Iowa. So they all quit en masse. He managed to, I suppose, in terms of the audience, he managed to come across with a couple of cogent remarks. But the long and the short of it is that it seems that the punditry says that Romney did well because he didn't do poorly, which means that he's still the front runner, and that the star of the evening was Michelle Bachmann because she put sentences together and made a certain amount of sense. Now, of course, the bar was considerably lowered because previously she had accused a lot of Democrats of being traitors. She had referred to the founding fathers as having anguished slavery, which they tried monumentally to get rid of, which is a very peculiar reading of American history, given that a civil war was fought 100 years later over the very issue of slavery. And the one person who refused to sign the Declaration of Independence was warned, in fact, that there would be, that trying to finesse slavery in the Constitution would end up with a civil war. That was George Mason, one of the more prescient of the founding fathers, who was somewhat the intellectual mentor of both Jefferson and Washington. So she did well because she just seemed to make a little more sense than she normally does, although she does have a very strident quality to her voice. However, she did point out in announcing that she was running for president that she is a tax lawyer, the mother of five children, and the, I guess, godmother, stepmother, foster mother, I suppose is the right term, of 23 others. So that's quite a household. So that would be an interesting thing to find out more about. On the surface, it sounds like she's doing the Lord's work, and it's a wonderful thing to take care of all of these disadvantaged children who are unwanted children. That's one of the, of course, the criticisms of the right to life is that they are obsessed with abortion, but once the kids are born, they don't give a damn about them. And she certainly appears to be somebody that is walking the walk as well as talking the talk. So that will be interesting to find out more about that. Who else was on that? I mean, it was pretty painful for me to watch because, frankly, I cannot believe the caliber of all of these people and the reputation in Republican circles of Mitt Romney, the front runner, is that he's a phony, that he's just not a genuine person. I thought in many ways some light was shed on him by an interview I did the other day with a veteran reporter with the Boston Globe, who has covered Romney back when he ran in the last time and when he was governor of Massachusetts. And he was saying that the thing you have to understand about Romney is that he comes out of the corporate world. He's not a politician, but he's a guy that's used to having corporate public relations, corporate security, a wall where you come into the lobby. You've got to go through metal detectors and various private security to be ushered up to the suite to meet him. That's how corporations operate. Politicians and politics is not the same as the corporate America. You know, the halls of Congress are open. It's supposed to be the people's house. So, and reporters do have fairly free and open access to politicians who are quite often willing to talk. Some of them talk too much, like Anthony Weiner. But the long and the short of it is that he is a very much a corporate creature. And if he does become president of the United States, I think it will move this country further into a more corporate direction. He'll be the CEO of America, and I don't think he has the instincts or understandings of how different the public square is from the corporate office tower. And it's actually a very grim prognosis to my mind. But the good news is he's so boring, and so inauthentic. And the other guy, the other Mormon, if you will, who wasn't there last night, is apparently a very interesting guy. He's a very smart guy, very articulate. He's the former U.S. ambassador to China. He speaks Mandarin Chinese. And he's the kind of candidate that the Republican establishment's been trying to get to run because they think he could really take on Obama. And, of course, in electoral terms, it makes far more sense for the Republicans to run a centrist to a moderate as opposed to a far right-wing Tea Party bomb thrower, because that constituency is fairly narrow, even though it's a dedicated one. And Palin certainly got that constituency wrapped up. But Obama will get elected with the center, as will the Republican. And the Republican establishment seem to think that Huntsman is the best guy, at least that's my understanding of it, to beat Obama. But that's not how the system works. And it's so strange to me that so many liberals are just obsessed with Sarah Palin, and so many people give her free publicity by talking about her all the time. And the reality is that the progressives and liberals should be praying that the Republican Party nominate her, because if they care about four more years of having Democrats in control of the executive branch, with the Supreme Court hanging by the balance, that one more far-right wing winger like the four or five Catholic boys that are in there now, this country would be back, you know, probably to the 18th, 17th century almost, maybe the 14th, maybe it'd be almost like the Taliban. They are so reactionary, the Alito, Scalia, Roberts. They are such corporatists. It's quite scary. So it could be a very grim and difficult road for President Obama to get reelected, because the people, that the record numbers that voted for him back in 2008, didn't show up in 2010, and the real question is, will they show up in 2012? You have been listening to me ramble because our guest didn't show. I'd like to thank Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter, and this program's available at emasters.com. Not this one, by the way. And I will be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. Bye for now.